coming to you from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, by way of Stone Mountain, Georgia, birthed by the great state of South Carolina, is the Bryant Land Country Podcast, your place for any and everything in hunting, fishing, sports, and outdoor related, with heavy doses of randomness, guests, and an all-around good time. Here's your host, proud Gamecock, South Carolina forever, AB3.
It's another week here on the Bryantland Country Podcast, and we are rolling along, man. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for taking the time to download, coming in, and listen to the Bryantland Country Podcast. I am your host, AB3. Thank you for listening, downloading, wherever you consume, or whatever you use to consume, I should say, your podcast, whether it's TuneIn, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Podcoin, Radio Play. Man, we just thank y'all for listening and downloading this podcast. Make sure if you are listening to us on the Apple Podcast deal that you're leaving the 5-star ratings, leaving us great reviews. We love to see it. We love to know that we are giving you what you want. This week on the podcast, the guest is Lance Krueger from Lance Krueger Photography down in Texas. Man, if you go to Lance's Instagram page, Lance_Krueger, you will see some badass pics of wildlife, turkeys, deer, hogs, largemouth bass, just anything that you can think of that sportsmen are out there pursuing. Lance has photographed it. We had a great conversation just talking about his background, how he got started taking pictures, his love for the outdoors, even got some tips in there for setting blinds and picking out cameras and things like that. So this is going to be a 2-part interview. This week is going to be part one, and then we're going to wrap it up next week with part two. But man, I'm telling you, you guys are really going to enjoy Lance. He's got a lot to say, got a lot of tidbits and stuff. So I'm going to fall back and move out of the way. You guys kick back and enjoy my conversation with Lance Krueger on the Bryantland Country Podcast. All right, I got Lance Krueger on the line here with the Bryantland Country Podcast, and I've really been wanting to talk to you for a while just because I've gone through the stuff that you have on your Instagram and just other photos that I've seen. And I think I commented on one of your photos. It's like, man, you take some badass pictures. Welcome to the Bryantland Podcast, and thanks for joining me. I really meant that. You take some really good stuff, man.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you having me.
So I was going through some of the information that I got for you doing like my research and stuff. And one of the things that actually kind of cracked me up, it says, you know, from Texas where everything will bite, poke, or sting you. And it's so funny because that immediately brought back a hunting trip that I went on with my son, a hunting and ATV riding trip I went on with my son a few years ago. And I came back with this big lump on the back of my neck. And I think it ended up being like a spider. It wasn't too bad, but it was like the biggest lump. And I was just like, it's definitely not a mosquito. And we went out there, it's like July out there or whatever. And I was like, it's definitely not a mosquito. But when I saw that, I was just like, yep, that pretty much sums up Texas for me.
Yep. Especially going where I'm at. I live 8 miles north of Mexico. I'm at the bottom tip of Texas. Down in McAllen, Texas is where I live. Down here, we've got cactus. We've got mesquite trees with 2-inch long thorns on them. Cat claw brush. Every plant on it down here, because it's basically like desert habitat, has some sort of protection to keep stuff from eating it. We've got rattlesnakes, we have coyotes, bobcats, mountain lions, all that kind of stuff. Down here is where the famed chupacabra came from, whatever that is. I think it's just people see a mangy coyote that has no hair on it, and they've come up with the name chupacabra down here. Yeah, we got mosquitoes, we got brown recluse spiders, black widows. I mean, every kind of thing that can bite, poke, or sting you, we've got it down here. This is where the killer bees came in from Africa, eventually into Mexico, came up here. Actually, we have a hockey team down here called the Killer Bees is their title.
Wow.
Or their mascot. And so, yeah, truly everything down here bites, pokes, or sting you. I've got a guy that is a friend of mine that I graduated from high school from, and he was out shredding a field and ran over a killer bee nest and couldn't get back to his truck. It was an open tractor he was on, and he got killed out on this property. And so it's very true, man. Rattlesnakes. I just was photographing turkeys this weekend. Right there by the gate, as I was leaving the ranch, there was a rattlesnake, and I ended up having to kill it because, you know, anytime it's around houses or gates where people can get out, the ranch owner's grandkids can get out and have a chance of getting struck by one of these guys, I kill them around there. If they're out in the brush or whatever, I leave them alone. But it depends on the landowner's thing. But, you know, I just killed a rattlesnake Saturday night, two nights ago.
Jesus.
So I deal with rattlesnakes, and, you know, we've got coral snakes down here, which are have the same venom as cobras, though they don't really, you know, strike at you or anything. You'd have to really try hard for them to really bite you, but because they got such small mouths and small teeth. But, yeah, I deal with everything that'll bite poker snake. Yeah, I've got, you know, cactus thorns in me all the time and, you know, bites and everything else. So it's very true. Everything does bite, poke, or sting you down here.
Now, you are considered the top, or one of the top, from what I've seen so far, I would say the top white-tailed deer photographer. But before you got into photography and stuff, I was reading, said you had like a sketch pad, and then you just started out sketching just like photos of animals and just other things that interested you?
Yeah. When I was a kid, I started drawing when I was, I think, about 5 years old. I was really interested in horses at the time, and I would do, I think my very first picture I ever drew, my dad and I had watched a horse race, you know, like, I don't know if it was Secretariat or something like that when I was a little kid. Anyway, drew like these horses racing with jockeys on their back, and was really into horses and really into World War II airplanes when I was in, you know, elementary and junior high, because we'd go to the air shows and see that. And then I'd draw hunting and fishing scenes as I got into hunting and fishing more when I was a teenager. You know, then I got into white-tailed deer. And so I was my creative outlet. I guess I always had this desire to create. And so I sketched and painted and drew stuff and thought I would be an artist. That was one of the things I thought I would do early on in my life. I you know, how you are as a kid, you think you're going to do all these different things. And one of the things I thought I would be was an artist. And at 16, that's when I bought my first camera. Ever since then, I haven't picked up the sketchbook. My creative outlet has been my cameras and my photos that I shoot, you know. And so started at 16 years old. My dad was managing a ranch here in South Texas, a 2,800 acre ranch that had, you know, all kinds of exotic animals on it. There was a hunting ranch. They had, you know, like these endangered bonnie buck from Africa, and they had ostrich and zebras and all these different types of animals, axis deer and, you know, fallow deer and different stuff. They even had rhinos on this place, black rhinoceros, because they were trying to start a breeding population here in the United States.
Oh, wow.
Because of all the problem with the horns getting cut off and poaching over in Africa. And if they started a population of rhinoceros in Africa, that'd be the poacher's dream situation to have them all pinned up,
right,
and, you know, in a small area. So they were trying to do it in Texas whenever the Asian market went down on the price of ground rhino horn as an aphrodisiac. The rhino population started going back up, so they quit doing this project they had here in South Texas.
That was something that I was curious about, because I saw where you said, you know, it had like black bucks from India, and then the eland, and then the rhinos, and even the ostrich with, I think, what was it, 16 eggs or something like that. So I was wondering, were you traveling at a young age? But I get it now, because, yeah,
no,
I got
no.
you. Because in Texas, you guys
that was
do have
the ranch my dad
okay,
managed.
The exotics. Okay, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, they were all imported over from Africa, and they brought them over here because the landowner, the owner of that ranch, would travel to Africa every year and hunt. And he just, you know, loved it so much that he brought over animals that, you know, he had on his ranch, you know, people could hunt. But there was also a lot of animals that he brought over for conservation reasons that he had there just to, you know, like the bonnie buck antelope. It was, you know, there was only a few of them in existence at the time. And he wanted to start a population over here. And they actually had a baby while I was out there. And I got photos on like my first roll of film. Slide film way back in 1985 of, you know, those animals and of the rhinos and different stuff. And so that's what I was talking about there is my first roll of film, some of the stuff that I had on that first roll of film. But the one animal that was the thing that I just was drawn to as a kid, younger, you know, when I was sketching pictures and stuff, looking at the hunting magazines and that kind of stuff, it was the white-tailed deer. And on that first roll of film, I got photos because it was summertime It was like in June, and got photos of a white-tailed doe with a fawn and on that first roll of film that I shot. And so that's kind of where my passion and love for white-tailed deer started, on that first roll of film. You know, even though I had all these other animals, I had my bird dog on there, you know, my quail dog, had black buck, a record buck, black buck antelope from out at the ranch. But, you know, all these exotic animals, and I still love the exotics, you know, they're cool. But my passion and love in photography is white-tailed deer by far. And it was kind of neat to have a deer on my first roll of film. And I still have that slide, you know, with the other photos that I shot, you know, back, 1985, I was 16 years old. I just turned 50 last week. And so that was, 34 years ago, something like
that. Happy belated birthday, too.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you. So anyway, so that's where it started.
Let me ask you this. So, you know, you got your sketch pad and, you know, you're sketching your photos and you're going through that. Did you do a lot of hunting as a kid as well? Like, did you, I know you said you're a big fisherman and stuff. Did you hunt a lot in your younger days before you picked up the camera and the sketch pad?
Well, my dad was actually a gunsmith for like 25 years. And so I was born into a family that my dad was a hunter. He was a fisherman, and his specialty in the Central Texas area was where I lived as a, you know, as a kid until I was 12 years old, was he owned a gun shop up in the Seguin and Gonzales, Texas area, up in Central Texas, up by San Antonio. We went hunting, fishing, camping just about every weekend. Every Saturday we were out hunting or fishing somewhere. But the thing is, you know, we ended up moving to South Texas because my dad sold his businesses there, came to work down here. And we didn't have I didn't grow up with an affluent family or anything like that. And here in Texas, everything you hunt, you have to pay for, basically, to go hunting on ranches and stuff like that. And it was kind of high dollar and something that my parents didn't have in the budget when I was a kid. So I didn't deer hunt until I was, I think, 15, 16 years old. But when I was younger, we dove hunted and quail hunted because we could always find places to dove and quail hunt. We did some goose hunting. We also fished a lot. Bass fishing was our other big thing when I was a kid. And actually, you know, one of those other many things that I wanted to be when I was growing up was I thought I wanted to be a professional bass fisherman on the, you know, bass tournament trail and all that stuff. Hunted, you know, dove and quail and those kind of animals, predators, that kind of stuff. Stuff that we could do for cheap that we didn't have to pay $5,000 to go on a deer hunt, you know, here in South Texas. But then I had my first deer hunt that I actually killed a deer on was at 16 years old. A friend of my parents had taken me when I was 15. I shot at a doe, I think wounded her. We never found her. Got dogs out there, all that kind of stuff, trying to find her. Never found her. But at 16 years old, I went on a hunt on the ranch that my dad was managing, the same basic year that I got my first camera, and shot a doe. And my brother shot a doe on that same hunt. And we're just trying to, you know, help out with the management of the ranch because they manage the deer numbers so that, you know, there weren't too many does, so that there's more bucks on the property and that kind of thing.
Right.
And but hunted all my life. And, you know, when I got to the age where I was traveling more, I've hunted all over the United States. I've hunted in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Missouri. I hunted even in Manitoba, Canada. Up on the Saskatchewan border, up in the Duck Mountains, hunting for deer up there. And they had wolves. They had elk in the Duck Mountains up there. You know, I've hunted all over the United States. And I've actually guided deer hunters also is another thing that I would do when I was back in my 20s. Something I would do with the guiding is, you know, as places I was already photographing on, like up in Michigan and Missouri, and these, you know, landowners got to know me and they saw that I really knew, you know, what I was talking about as far as aging deer on the hoof and judging rack score and all that kind of stuff. And so they asked me, hey, would you mind guiding? And so they told me they'd pay me X number of dollars a week. And so what I would do when I was in my 20s, you know, as soon as I graduated from college, you know, I was like 24 at the time, didn't have a lot of money, trying to make photography a career, I would actually save up enough money to be able to get all the way to Michigan, but I would travel and photograph for 2 months on the way up there and photograph all these deer hotspots on the way up in the big buck states on the way up to Michigan. And I'd spend 2 months going up, a month of guiding, and I made enough money off of the pay that they gave me per week to guide and tips from the hunters that, you know, shot deer. And I made enough money then to basically make it back home because I spent all my money that I had saved up on the way to Michigan. Then I got fed and everything while I was there, and then, you know, made enough money off tips and pay to be able to make it back home, and I'd photograph for a month or so on the way back home. So wow. I'd be gone like 4 months of the fall.
That would be a great way to, as you said, like collecting photographs and stuff. Like you're paying your own way, and you're building, not only building your resume, but building your collection and stuff with the photographs.
Right, exactly. And, you know, I was early on in my career, and I was already starting to get published in the national magazines by then. And that was at the age, I graduated at 24 years old. It took me 7 years to get a marketing degree at the University of Texas, Pan American down here in South Texas. And so I was young in my career, and I'd been part-time up until then. But then I started traveling like the day after I graduated. I graduated in December with this business degree. And the day after I graduated, I went on assignment up to Montana to photograph mule deer for a magazine. And I'd been building my portfolio, and I'd been selling to them since I was 19 years old. That's when I sold my first photo, was at 19. I went part-time professional at 21 while I was in college, putting myself through college because my parents didn't have the money to put me through college, but I was paying for my own school and all that kind of stuff, working all summer long, trying to make enough money to pay for tuition the next year, which I would do. You know, I was shooting photos, ended up, you know, having that as my full-time career starting at 24, and then started traveling. That's when I started doing the guiding, build up my photo supply, because editors are always looking for photos of stuff that, you know, you don't even think about shooting, you know, and so you've just got to be out there a lot, photograph everything that happens in front of you when you're sitting in a blind.
Right.
Hopefully you get, you know, just spend enough time out there that you get a good supply of photos and you've got the stuff that they need in the future. Because when you shoot photos for the magazine, you shoot 1 year. Like, let's say you're there during the fall colors in October. Well, the magazines have already printed all the magazines that are out in October. And they've been searching for the photos for that back 4 months in advance, you know, back in the past. So you've got to shoot the photos 1 October, trying to get them published the next October, a year later, or even 5 years down the road later on. But you don't ever shoot photos for that particular issue that's out that month, because it's already on the newsstand. They've already picked all the articles. They've done all the layout. They've done all the printing and all that stuff months and months in advance.
Gotcha.
So you're always shooting for the future. You never know what a magazine is going to want as a freelance photographer like I am. And so you have to shoot photos, guessing and hoping that that's the kind of photos that the editors of the magazines are going to want down the road someday. So anyways, that's when I would travel around and, you know, shoot all the photos on the way up to Michigan and a couple months of that. And then, you know, I would guide for 4 days, 3 days off. And on my days off, I would shoot photos. I would shoot even when I was guiding, you know, hunters, like if they shot a deer or something like that, do like a guy dragging a deer out and stuff right. like that. Then a whole month back. And that was 4 months shooting photos of deer specifically. And then I would take a month during the spring and shoot turkey photos. And then another month in the summer shooting bass fishing photos. So during that time in my life when I was single, right out of college, I would be going for 6 months of the year. And then the other 6 months of the year was when I was trying to get my photos to the magazines, to the editors, and selling them. So 6 months shooting, 6 months selling the photos, or trying to anyway.
What would you say, like if you had to just take like a guess, what would you say like the number of hours that you've logged in a blind to just photographing?
Oh, man. It's thousands. I have no idea. I mean, you think about it. I've been shooting photos for 34 years now.
34 years, right.
Yeah. And, you know, I used to be gone when I was single, 6 months of the year photographing. Every day was either in a blind or in the woods of some sort trying to photograph. And then times 30 years or whatever, I have no idea what that adds up to. It's thousands, tens of thousands of hours. I mean, I have no earthly idea. You know, nowadays I don't travel as much. You know, I'm married now, I have 4 kids. I travel about 3 to 4 months of the year. It's not the 6 months that I used to go. And that even if you add that up over the last 20 years I've been married, that adds up to a lot of hours sitting in blinds. And that's mainly how I photograph. You know, I shoot more photos out of blinds than any other technique. I do a lot of rattling. I do camo out and stuff like that. I don't do a ton of stalking or any of that kind of stuff. You know, I do sometimes, you know, if I'm walking out and I see a buck or whatever, walking out of my blind and I see a deer that's bedded or something, I'll stalk up on him and stuff like that. But I don't specifically go out there just to stalk unless I think that it's the best technique for that day and that particular property or whatever. But blinds is how I shoot most of my photos.
Now, let me ask you this, because I want to go back. A lot of my audience, a lot of people that listen to my podcast are new hunters. They're getting started, whether it's bow hunting or, you know, bow hunting deer or going deer hunting. And you said something a few minutes back that I kind of jotted down and thought was interesting. Aging deer on the hoof. I've read right. about it and kind of understand how it works. Could you explain exactly what you're doing when you're aging deer on the hoof and just kind of how that all, you know, comes together and how fast that can be as well, you know, out in the wild with deer?
Well, you know, I've written articles about how to age deer on the hoof. I actually, last night on my Instagram, I talked about two ways of how to age deer on the hoof. One of them is by looking at the brisket between their front legs. You know, it's where basically the chest meets up, or the belly of the deer meets up with the neck. And I talk about the angles of that. An older a deer gets, the more angled the brisket will be, closer to a 90 degree angle. Compared to a young buck, that brisket muscle is much tighter up to the chest. And so instead of a 90 degree angle, it'll be like a 20 degree angle. It's like very tight where the transition goes from the neck to the belly. But, you know, and I showed a photo where there was a 2-year-old buck, and you can see that how tight the brisket is to the chest. Now, a 4-year-old deer, it's about a 45 degree angle. And a 6-year-old or older deer, it'll be a 90 degree angle. That's one of the easiest, most consistent ways that I can look at a deer and tell is by looking at the brisket. But probably my favorite way of telling age of a deer is by looking at their face. And the last thing you want to do, and a lot of people try to do that, is they try to say, well, you know, this deer is so-and-so years old because of the size of the antlers. But with every deer, there's a different genetic makeup for the antlers. Some deer that are the same age will have big racks, and others will have little racks. And so that's why you don't want to use antlers as an indication of age. And a lot of people try to use that as an indicator, but it's not. It's very inconsistent and very inaccurate. So what I like to do is, when I'm sitting in a blind, I will physically take my fingers right in front of, or my hand right in front of my eyes, you know, 6 inches in front of my face, and cover up the deer's rack from my vision and just look at his face. And if you look at a deer's face, you will see that they are either very doe-like if they're young, to very bossy looking if they're old. A young buck, a 1-year-old or 2-year-old buck, if you cover up his rack with your hand and just look at his face, he will look just like a doe because he's so young. He's very feminine looking, very young looking.
Right.
But then as they mature, they start getting more of an angular type face. Part of it is because they're filling out, their facial features are filling out, their facial features are becoming more chiseled. The skin on their face will start sagging to the point when they're like 6 years old and older, they will actually have what I call wattles, like a turkey has,
right,
hanging down under their chin, where basically their chin meets their neck. They'll have like, you know, 1 or 2 wattles of skin hanging down. And from the side, that angle just keeps getting wider and wider, and their face gets more full because of that skin kind of sagging down. And so whenever I see a deer with wattles hanging down under their chin, I know that that deer is at least 6 years old. They'll start it a little bit when they're 5.5 years old, but the older they get, that skin will start hanging down. And it's kind of what happens with a brisket also. I've seen deer, you know, 12, 13 years old that are so old that their brisket will flap around between their legs while they're running or walking. Kind of like an old lady that's waving at you and she has the skin flopping under her arms.
Right.
Well, yep. That deer does the same thing with its brisket and with the skin hanging down under its face, those wattles that it has. So the best way to look at a deer or to tell the age is the more doe-like he looks, the more or feminine he looks, the younger he is. The more mature he is, the more his face will look chiseled and older and distinguished. And the best way to do that is reading up on articles, magazine articles. There's a book out there that is written by a friend of mine named Dave Richards. I'm trying to remember the name of the book, basically it shows you photographically from 1 year to the next deer over the years as they mature. And so it tells you indicators. That you can also tell that their bodies are deeper and thicker. And so as they get older, their legs look shorter, but they're not actually shorter. It's just they appear to be shorter because their body is getting thicker from their top of their body to their belly, and their belly will hang down more just like my belly hangs down more at 50 years old than when I was 20 years old. So a two-year-old buck, it seems like they're all legs. You know, just like a boy that's 12 years old, they seem like they're all legs and bony right. knees and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Well, it's just they haven't matured and they haven't filled out yet. And a young whitetail buck, 1 or 2 year old buck, will look like he's all legs and has a little thin, tight body. His belly won't sag down. His brisket won't sag down. His brisket's tight to his chest. But as they get older, their belly starts sagging more. Their brisket starts, you know, sagging down more. That becomes more of a 90-degree angle. And it's just because when they're young, they're trying to build their muscular and skeletal growth. And that's why most of their nutrition goes to their muscular and skeletal growth for them to grow their bodies. And that's why they don't have big racks when they're little. They're eating all this high nutrition, you know, 20%, 19% protein food, but it doesn't go to rack until they're at least 4 years old. And then when they're pretty much done growing their body and they're just filling out from their muscular and skeletal growth at that point from 4 year old and on, that's why their racks start getting bigger, because more of that nutrition, a higher percentage goes to rack. And that's why they peak out at 5 and 6 years old, because almost everything's going to rack at that age, even 7 years old. But then what happens is at 7 to 8 years old, they start going downhill, because what happens is as they're feeding on the ground, eating, you know, forbs and little weed shoots and stuff like that on the ground, they get a lot of sand in their diet. And so that wears down their teeth. And what will happen is when they get to that 7 to 8 year old range, 9 year old range, their body condition starts going down, their racks start getting smaller. Because even though most of the nutrition is going to rack still at that point, they are passing through more of that nutrition and it goes out the back end because the food isn't efficiently ground up like it was when they were 5 and 6 years old, when they had more teeth.
Right.
And that's how they are able to tell when you shoot a deer, that a biologist can tell how old a deer is by looking at tooth wear. The more ground down it is, the older the deer is, because they know that for every bite he takes, there's a certain amount of sand and whatever that gets into their mouth that they're chewing up with whatever they're eating, and that causes tooth wear, just like sandpaper. You know, it's sand, same stuff. And so as they chew more and eat more over the years, their teeth just keep getting worn down more and more and more over the years, to the point where it's down to the gums. And they'll eventually die if a coyote doesn't get them or something like that, because they can hardly even chew up their food. And so eventually that's what they die of, old age.
Wow. Because I have seen things written where, you know, reading and whatnot, talking about how deer get smaller, like you said, as they get older. I never knew that that was the reason why. And I've also started paying more attention when I'm out in the field and also looking at, you know, trail cam pictures. And it's funny because, like you said, if you look past their racks or whatever and you just look like at their face or look at their body, they're very, you know, like childlike. It's almost like, you know, like you said, looking at like a human child or whatever, like, you know, when they're younger, they're lankier right. and stuff. And then as they get older, they get heavier and flabbier, or, you know, get heavier and muscular, you know, depending on what part of the country that they're in.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And there's also some things I see a lot of misinformation out there where people are trying to say, well, this deer has a real gray face, and so that means he's old. Well, I photographed deer.
I've never heard
from
that before.
When they were.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. That's, you know, because a lot of people think that they do like humans do and like dogs do. You know, because you know how a dog will get gray in their face. You know, they'll start growing gray hair the older they get. You know, usually right. when they're at least 8 years old or so. Well, deer don't do that. I've got photos of deer, you know, that I've photographed over the years from 1 year old all the way until they were like 13 years old. And you can look at those pictures over the years, and their face was as gray at 1 year old as it was 13 years old, or as brown at 1 year old as it was at 13 years old. And gray hair in the face of a deer is not something that comes on with age. If they've got a gray face, it's because they were born with the genetics of having a gray face. You know, every deer is different. There's even, you know, deer that I photograph that don't have antlers. And people are like, how do you know that that's the same deer? Well, it's just like you can look at a human being and I can look at you and say, hey, that's Adam Bryant III. I can look at somebody else and know that is that person. They've got a different face just like humans do. Most people don't realize it because they're shooting at a deer at 100 yards away at 2 seconds after seeing them. They don't get to experience having five bucks standing within 30 yards of my blind where I can compare a big mature 6-year-old buck and a 1-year-old buck and be able to photograph them year after year after year and seeing the changes in their bodies, being able to compare photographically, because they're secretive. It's kind of almost like I'm a fly on the wall, almost like I'm, you know, I remember when I was a kid, I wanted to be invisible and be able to check things out because I was invisible. Well, the closest thing I found to that is by sitting in a, you know, blind photographing them. I've been able to see so many deer side by side. When you've got two deer side by side, look at their face. When you really evaluate them, especially with a telephoto lens or binoculars, you can tell how different their faces look. Every deer has a different look. And even when they don't have antlers, I know that that's so-and-so buck. You know, I'll name these deer, come up with some name so I can distinguish them, or the ranch owner will have a name for them. I know that that's Big Boy or whatever this deer's name is, Golden Boy or whatever. Right. I know that that's him. And even when he doesn't have his rack, and everybody thinks that's the only way to really tell a deer apart is his rack, you can tell does apart. Every deer has a different look to their face, just like human beings do.
But as you said, that comes from, you know, the experience and being close to them. And it also, to me, just sitting here listening to you talk about it, it's almost kind of like more like bow hunting, because, you know, with bow hunting, obviously you want to try to get close. And, you know, a lot of times you're in the blind and whatnot. And once you get those animals closer, like you said, if you take the time and just kind of look at them and not just popping them, you know, the first, you know, minute or two or whatever, first couple seconds that they come through, you can actually look at them and learn a lot and just kind of watch their movements and study, you know, their movements and how they interact with each other. It's funny because on my turkey hunt in Kansas, and I talked about it, you know, in one of my other podcasts, you know, I went out there, I wasn't successful, but I still, as far as wasn't successful as far as being able to take a turkey, but where I went, they had plenty of deer. And one of the coolest things for me during that hunt was sitting there watching the deer feed and being able to see the nubs, like where the new growth, where the antlers were coming in. I've never seen anything like that before. And just being able to look at their right. body structure and stuff like that, that was amazing to me.
Right, right. Well, people on Instagram, you know, are always asking me, because I've got photos of big deer, you know, that I show, and I've got tons of, you know, little deer photos, but people don't want to look at little deer photos. They want to look at big racked, you know, mature bucks. And so that's usually what I show. And people are always asking me, DMing me behind the scenes, asking me in the comments, you know, how do you photograph these deer? You know, what's your secret? What's the magic bullet, you know, that gets you to be so, you know, so close to all these big deer? And it's not the answer that they want to hear. The answer that I give them is time in the field, because you can do, you know, buy all these products that, you know, claim that they're going to give you more success with deer sense and all these different things. And those things do help. But the number one thing that I have that most people don't put in is time in the field, sitting there waiting. You know, how many guys spend 4 months of the year in the woods? See, I'm kind of like a catch and release hunter. I go and I can photograph deer and shoot them as many times as I want with my camera, because I'm not harming them. I can go before the season and I can shoot as many deer as I want. I don't have any limits, any bag limits or any of that kind of stuff. And I can photograph after the season.
Right.
I can photograph all year round. By doing that, I'm logging hours sitting in a blind observing deer, or even if I'm scouting, because I do a lot of scouting trying to figure out where to set up blinds and stuff like that.
Yep.
And so even if it's from a distance, you can see and learn about deer movements if you're 200 yards away, 300 yards away, overlooking, you know, from a high spot to a field below, you know, a food plot or something, where the deer come in. And so the more time you spend in the field, the more success you're going to have, because you learn deer behavior. There's a saying that I like to say, that I know what deer are going to do before deer do it.
I saw that.
Is very true, because if you spend enough time out there, you learn when, you know, two deer are coming together, what they're about to do. And if they're equally matched, you know that they're going to fight before they even get their ears laid back.
Right.
And just by telling behavior from what their body is doing, their body behavior, the way they hold their eyes, stuff like that, you can know what they're going to do before they even do it. You know, it may be thinking, you know, that it may be them thinking it, but you know what they're going to do. You know what's going through their mind before it even happens. And so I don't have any kind of magic bullet or anything that's going to, you know, make your hunting so much easier. What you've got to do is spend time in the field. And also the other thing is, you've got to go to places that big deer like that live. And so that's why I concentrate on going to the big buck states, you know, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, you know, all the big deer states, that's where I travel to.
Yep.
And I, you know, I've been photographing up in the Midwest for 25 years now, and I've whittled down the very, very best places down to the best of the very best that I found over those 25 years. Some places I still go to after 25 years. Other places I go there for a year or two, it's really good. And then, you know, it gets hunted too hard, or they have some kind of UHD or something where, you know, the deer get, you know, midge flies in their nose and they ended up dying and stuff like that. So I'm always looking for new places. You know, with wildlife photography, by spending the distances, like what you said a while ago about, you know, being basically at bow hunting range, because most of my photos are taken at 50 yards and less. And most in my cover shots, most of those are taken from 15 to 25 yards, depending on the lens that I'm using. And so I set up my blinds very close to where I think the deer are going to come out, whether that's a scrape or a rub line or a deer trail or a feeder or a mineral lick or whatever, or a water hole or whatever. I will set my blind up at the distance that I need to get the shot with the lenses that I've got. And so what happens is I've got bow hunting distance, which bow hunting introduces a whole different set of difficulty because of your limited range. You can't shoot at a deer at 150 yards with a bow like you can with a deer rifle. And so I've got the same distance as a bow hunter, but where it gets even more difficult is that I have to worry about lighting angle, backgrounds that a bow hunter, he doesn't care about. He can shoot in any direction wherever the deer is.
Right.
As long as he can see it and see it in his sights, he can shoot it. But with wildlife photography, I have to take bow hunting to a whole different level by worrying about what the background looks like, the foreground, what the lighting angle is on the deer. Is this going to be, you know, conducive for a good photo?
Mm.
And plus, I've got to be on the ground. I can't be up in a tree stand and get my scent above them and stuff like that. So anyway, so there's a level of difficulty with that. But the advantage that I have and the thing that I'm able to do that a bow hunter can't do is I could shoot 100 deer in a year, and I can shoot them over and over and over. A bow hunter can't do that. He's got bag limits, he's got tags, all that kind of stuff. I'm a bow hunter myself. I killed my first buck when I was 25 years old in Illinois with a bow and arrow. You know, I love to bow hunt and deer hunt any way I can. But I feel like when I come from wildlife photography to hunting, it's easier in some respects, but I'm limited by hunting seasons and bag limits and that kind of thing that makes it tougher. But what I tell people is instead be like a wildlife photographer or even be a wildlife photographer yourself. Take your family's video camera out and just go sit in the woods and spend time in the woods, time in the field, and go and scout things out. If you spend as much time as I do in the woods before the season, your success rate would go up so much more, and you would have so much more chance of killing bigger deer than you've ever killed because you know the areas that the deer aren't coming to. You need to go to areas where a big deer exists. You know, you're not going to kill a Boone and Crockett deer if no Boone and Crockett deer exist on your property or the surrounding properties or even in your county. There's some counties where they've never killed a Boone and Crockett deer. Well, probably you're not going to kill one just because you hope you're going to kill one.
Right.
You need to go spend the time and figure that out. And if they're not there, then find a property that does have a deer of that size on it, or, you know, several deer of that size that you want to kill, whether that's a 150-inch deer or a 160, or if you're wanting to shoot a 170 Boone Crockett deer or whatever, or a Pope and Young 125-incher that's going to make it, you know, depending on how you're hunting.
Right.
You've got to go to the places that those deer exist. If they don't exist, you're more than likely never going to kill one unless one just happens to be during the rut and just walk through your property and you luck out. But when I'm photographing around the United States, I don't have time to, at every place I go, to spend a month at each place. A lot of times I'm in a place for 3 days. And so I've got to try to go to the places that I have the highest chance of success. And so if you're, you know, going to be trying to hunt at a place where those deer don't exist, then you're not going to have any chance of getting them. And I would have the same thing happen to me. I'd sit in a place and not get any photos because a deer of what I'm, you know, the size that I'm trying to photograph does not exist. You know, a cover caliber buck, they have to be on the property for me to have a chance at them. Because so many of these places I go to, the deer are heavily hunted. The deer are on the property, but they're nocturnal.
Right.
So I deal with that all the time. I was in Ohio just last April, and I was trying to photograph, you know, what I, you know, was told by the landowner was the biggest buck they had on the ranch. He was a 200, they figured he was about 210 inches. And he was a big 6x6, big mature buck. And I sat there for 4 days straight in extremely cold temperatures and in the snow. And they got him on trail camera. but I never saw him in daylight. I never, the only time I saw him was on the trail camera that they showed me, and they said, this is what he looks like. That's the only reason I knew he even existed, because I never saw him in 4 days.
Wow.
So, you know, you just got to spend time in the field. That is my secret. Time in the field that I spent over the years, and I've learned, and I've got such a huge database of behaviors and experiences with deer in my head that I remember, and I will do things that will up my chances of success by moving my blind or setting up and rattling, determining this is the day I need to rattle because of, you know, all these other times in the past that I was successful on this day or in this situation here. And you've just got to be flexible, but have that knowledge base in your head so that you can rely on that and refer back to that and know what to do in the future.
And see, that was what I wanted.
So that's my secret to success.
That's what I wanted to ask you, because like a lot of times two things came out of that that I wanted to ask you. One, and you kind of went through it, like your process of getting these photos and setting up your blinds, you know, looking at sunlight and, you know, obviously wind direction and stuff with the scent. But do you go, like you said, when you go in and you scout, do you worry about, or would you say for someone who is hunting a smaller property, would you worry about educating the deer? Like you say, you know, just going in and spending time, because, you know, people talk so much about like educating animals, you know, educating the deer, educating the turkey and stuff. But if you want to go in the off season and just kind of watch, or just kind of, you know, like take pictures, you know, have like a family outing or something like that, you know, where you're sitting in the blind, do you worry about like educating those animals? Or would you say that to somebody who's hunting on a smaller property, worry about educating the animals?
Well, that could be a potential problem if you're going into, if your property is like a sanctuary where the deer are feeling safe. When I'm photographing, I'm usually photographing on the fringes of those places and not going into the sanctuaries and busting them out of there. I'm being very quiet in the way that I do things. But my philosophy on a lot of that stuff is that the more time that you spend in the field and they're not having a negative human interaction, then they get to the point where they think, you know what? That smell isn't harmful to me. It's just like a farmer that's out there all the time. You know, he's got, you know, 100 acres and half of it's woods and half of it's corn and soybeans. He's out there every day. Do you think that those deer are going to run away just because he's got a tractor out there that smells like oil and gasoline and everything else, and he's not using scentlock clothing and stuff like that?
Right.
He's stinking. He's sweating and all that kind of stuff. The more positive human interaction that a deer has, I feel like they get used to humans where they're not, you know, if you're kind of going within the smells and the things that they're used to, then they will actually get to the point where they won't be so fearful. But if you are like going into their sanctuary, doing the things that the farmer would never do, you know, going into that super thick blackberry briar area where he would never go in there, but you know, that's where the deer are bedding and stuff like that. Going into there, I would never do that as a photographer. I'm always trying to go off on the edges, like the edge of the field where the deer come out and they have interactions with the farmer and that kind of thing. They smell the tractors. They smell the vehicles. They smell the sweat of the farmer and that kind of thing.
Right.
Where the problem is where you have negative human interaction. That's when you're going in and you're smelling a place up and you're shooting at stuff. And their buddies get, you know, the deer standing there with another deer and his buddy gets shot right next to him. Well, he associates humans with negative human interactions. And so they're going to get spookier because of that. To me, if you're going out there scouting, if you're going out there photographing, the more you're doing it where there's nothing negative happening, they're going to get used to that positive human interaction. And a case in point, when I go photograph at a place, I've spent as much as 2 weeks trying to photograph a deer that the first time he comes in, I know that the sound of my camera will spook him. He'll turn inside out running the other way when he hears one click from my camera, because they're so close to me. It's in deep woods. It's super silent. There's no wind. This deer is, you know, a hunted animal, been hunted since he was, you know, 3 years old or whatever. He's a 6-year-old buck now. He's super mature. And I followed a deer in front of my blind in a food plot for 5 minutes before I took one shot, because I knew that that one shot was all I was going to get that day. And I would do one click, and he would, you know, I waited until he had the perfect pose, look at another deer in the distance, or he hears a car off in the distance or something, and he throws his head up, puts his ears up, and is looking off. Boom, I'll take one shot, and he turns inside out trying to run the other way from that that sound of my camera. It's the same as like a guy shooting a bow at him. They're jumping the string, per se, or they're jumping my shutter noise. And so what they do is they run away. And in my mind, I imagine that deer ran away, and he's like, you know, finally stops, and he's huffing and puffing, and he's thinking, what was that sound? Well, he doesn't know what that sound was, but he knows it didn't hurt him. You know, I kind of, you know, joke with people. He's feeling around with his hooves around on his body. There's no holes in him. He's not bleeding or anything like that. He's, you know, thinks, man, okay, that wasn't so bad.
Right.
He goes back the next day. He shows up. I'm sitting there in the blind again. That day, I'll shoot two shots. Boom, boom, one after the other. He runs away again. And I keep doing that day after day until I get him to the point where he will allow me to shoot motor drive sequences, shooting at 10 frames a second, and he hardly even looks up at it anymore because he's had no negative human interaction. He's heard the sounds, but it hasn't hurt him, so he gets used to it after enough time. Same thing with guys being out in the woods and all that kind of stuff. They're going to smell human scent. But is that human scent only on opening day where they're hearing gunshots everywhere and they're seeing humans walking through the woods and they're hearing gunshots and they're seeing their buddies get shot? To me, if it's positive human interaction, then they're going to be okay with it compared to negative human interaction.
Kind of like coaxing them into a comfortability, leading them into a comfortability. Once they get comfortable, then it's just like, all right, well, I guess this is normal. So
Exactly. So I think you can actually condition a deer to the point where something that he used to be afraid of just 2 weeks before, he's not even afraid of now. Or he may look up at you and throw his ears up and be aware of it, but then he goes back to feeding.
It's funny you mention that because I'm sitting here and I just thought about that. Like on my property, like obviously I deer hunt my property, turkey hunt my property, but I also love to ride my ATV around. And, you know, I ride it slowly, you know, when I'm going and checking cameras and checking feeders and stuff. But, you know, I also make time just to enjoy and I cut loose on the trails and, you know, and all through the woods and stuff. And I may spook a deer. But then after I'm gone, like off in the distance, I look back and he's going back to doing what he was doing. So it was just like, no, you don't hear that ATV sound every day, but it's almost like something. I'm just like, okay, that scared me to death for a second. But oh yeah, now I remember I've heard that before. So it's really not a big deal.
Right. I would tell you to do is the more you ride your ATV out at your property, the more the deer will get used to it when you're not hunting in the off season. If you could be out there, just think of this. If you were on your ATV every day, 365 days of the year, and let's say you deer hunt out there for, you know, 10 days of 365 days, but they have 355 days of interaction with you and that sound of that vehicle, the smell of that vehicle, do you think that they would get used to that vehicle more or less? Or would they be spooked and just totally get off the property? No, they're going to get used to it. And so I think the more time you spend out there on the vehicle that you're going to be hunting or whatever, or driving to your blind with, the better. You know, one of my favorite things to do on properties is get on the tractor of the farmer that plows the fields and plants the fields and is out there that they hear that sound every day of the year, just about, or a big chunk of days out of the year. I like to go driving on those tractors with my cameras because the deer will let you drive right by them. Where if you were in a different vehicle or something that they're not used to, they're going to spook from it because they're not used to it. So the more you do it, the more you drive your ATV out there and it's in a positive human interaction, or there's no negative human interaction, I guess I could say. You're not shooting at them. If the only time you're out there with your ATV and they hear gunshots, they're going to think, man, something ain't right. You know, because it seems like the deer know the days of deer season, the start of deer season, better than we do. So
you ain't lying about that.
Yeah. So I'm thinking the more time that you're out there where it's not negative human interaction, you just see them, they run off, and they just see that you drive right by them, they're not going to be afraid of you, or they'll get less and less afraid of you. And a lot of times, they'll stand there in the brush, and as long as you don't stop, they'll let you drive right by them. And you can be looking at them, and they're 20 yards away, standing behind a bush or something, thinking they're perfectly hidden. And if you drive right by them, they'll stay right there, let you drive right by them.
And another interaction that I had that I always thought was kind of peculiar. Like, I remember one time in the off season, I was out and, you know, checking, you know, like I said, checking cameras, you know, putting out feed, whatever the case is. And it was deep in the woods and I was standing there and I could hear the deer coming. So I was just like, all right, if I don't make any sudden moves or anything, you know, just kind of let this happen and then go about my business. So I come and then, like, literally they're like two does that are maybe 100 feet away from me. And I mean, I'm sitting there, I'm looking at them, and I don't think they were really looking at me. They were kind of doing their thing, but they stopped. They didn't blow or anything. And I'm just standing there and I clapped my hands and they just stood there. And then, like, literally this went on for like 5 minutes. And then all of a sudden they just busted and took off. And I'm like, that would never happen during hunting season. Like,
if I was
in a blind or in a stand or something, the first time they get in the area, they would have just like took off. And I mean, and that, you know, just goes back to what you were talking about. You know, there are all kind of things, you know, out here, and some of them are helpful or whatever. But I mean, like, literally I'm walking in the woods with no kind of like scent cover or whatever. Like, I'm just out there, no camo. I mean, I didn't have on any blue or anything, but I didn't have on any camo, just, you know, like some neutral colored pants and a shirt, you know, no scent things or anything like that. I'm sweating because it's hot in Georgia, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they're just hanging out, just like, all right, well, we're just hanging out.
Well, think about
it. As soon as deer season comes, they're gone.
Think about it. They know that during that time of the year, they've never had a negative human interaction. They've never had anybody shoot at them during that time of the year. But they know when it starts to be, you know, cooler, they know, man, it's about the time of the year that usually the humans are coming out. They're wearing their orange. They're, you know, I'm hearing all these firecrackers in the background. You know, my best buddy got killed right next to me last year about this time of the year. They're going to be spookier during that time of the year because they've had more human interaction, negative human interaction that time of the year than they have during the summer or spring. They know that humans aren't bad during that time of the year per se. You know, they're not trying to kill them and that kind of thing. So they know the time of the year and they know when, you know, humans through the seasons typically are dangerous and when they need to evade them and when they're not dangerous, when it's okay to watch the humans, you know.
That's going to conclude part one of my conversation with Lance Krueger. But make sure you go in the notes section of the podcast and click on the link so you can follow Lance, see his work, keep up with what he has going on if you are not already familiar with Lance Krueger and Lance Krueger Photography. Before I get out of here, I just wanted to remind you guys of a couple things. Number one, we are working on a bigger, badder, greater, fresher, whatever adjective you want to put in, website, bryantlandcountry.com. It is almost finished. You can start going on the website now and see some of the new deals we got going on there. We're getting the podcast page up so you can listen to all the podcasts on the website. You can check out our videos, documentaries, or little mini docs that we've put together over the years. Hopefully the website will be finished here in the next couple weeks or so, but it is up, it is running. Make sure you go and check out bryantlandcountry.com. Thank you again for listening to the Brightland Country Podcast. Thank you for downloading. Remember to continue to tell 5 people, to tell 5 more people to listen to the Brightland Country Podcast. Man, I really appreciate y'all. I'm going to go ahead and get out of here. We'll catch y'all next week on another episode of the Brightland Country Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Bryantland Country Podcast, hosted by AB3. Please leave us a positive review and 5-star rating on iTunes. Be sure to check out our podcast section on our website, bryantlandcountry.com, for previous podcasts. Check us out on Instagram at Official Bryantland and Twitter at 3Bryantland. This has been an AB3 Media production. Join us next time for another edition of the Bryantland Country Podcast.